No surprise, but her music just blends in beautifully with our topic today. So thank you again. Gorgeous. There's a song. It's an old song, one from my era. I think it's by Simon and Garfunkel, and some of the words are, I am a rock, I am an island. Remember that song? And it goes through, you know, I stay in my room, no one touches me, and, you know, all of that. The very last words of that, though, are so telling, I think. Because a rock feels no pain, and an island never cries. You know, just kind of, oh, how sad. For somebody to shut down so completely, you know, that I want to be a rock, I want to be an island, because I don't want to feel any pain. And don't we do that? Maybe not to that degree, but we do. We avoid pain and discomfort if we possibly can in any and every way. We don't like to feel pain or discomfort. In fact, we're hardwired, actually, to if we feel pain, you know, to flee, you know, fight, flight, or freeze, whatever. We're hardwired to protect ourselves. But here in the 21st century, usually the pain that we're experiencing is not a tiger biting us. It is some emotional something or other that has happened. But our innate mechanisms don't always recognize that. So we go around trying to avoid, and we go to great lengths, I think, to avoid. We're talking this today about vulnerability, and we've been talking about daring greatly. In an effort to live as completely as we can, to be all that we can be, to fully develop, or as best we can, develop that higher self of us, that Christ self, it is in our best interest to not hide, to not try to avoid. It is in our best interest to dare greatly, as the book says. The phrase comes from the poem, or the speech that Teddy Roosevelt gave back in 1910. He talks about it is the one who goes out into the arena and gets dirty and dusty and sweaty and bloody, the one that really gets out there and gives it his all or her all, that's the one who will, if successful, will feel that wonderful sense of achievement, and even if you don't succeed, will feel a sense of, I've done all I can, you know, just a sense of pride, of self-worth. So daring greatly is something that we really would like to do. And it isn't, being vulnerable especially, is not comfortable. It is that time when we're, you know, it'd be so much easier just to avoid, to do something different. Vulnerability is not always, maybe I'd say even often, it is uncomfortable to be vulnerable. It is showing our underbellies, you know, when what we want to do is roll up and hide them. There are times that you know, you don't want to be walking around like this all the time. But to be vulnerable in the right times and in the right places and in the right ways will allow us to be the ones in that arena to be daring greatly, to be expanding, to be doing more. So, in the chapter on vulnerability, she says this. She says that that we, as humans, use, you know, we call them personas, we call them masks, we refer to armor, and the masks and the armor are wonderful symbols of what we do to run away from or to avoid vulnerability. And we might do that, we might be successful at avoiding it, but at what cost? A mask, do you guys remember Halloween and when they used to have those plastic full face masks? Yeah. The eyes weren't ever quite right, so you couldn't see real well. And it always felt like I couldn't breathe very well either. They were kind of suffocating. Masks are suffocating. So even if you have your mask on, you may be hiding and less vulnerable than if you were, you know, showing your true self. But it is suffocating to have that mask on. Armor. if you put on armor, now I've never had armor on, but I've seen it on in movies and on TV, even in museums, and while it will deflect arrows and all that sort of thing, it's supposed to be very heavy, very heavy. So you're walking around protected, but you're burdened by the weight of the armor. And it is, those are, she says, then are wonderful metaphors for how we go through life. Because if we are wearing these masks and wearing this armor, then we are not open and we are carrying huge burdens because of it. So as she talked about this vulnerability this time, she said that there are basically like three major ways that we shield ourselves from this. These are the major ones. There are some that are a few others extraneous or extra ones, but the major ones are foreboding joy, perfectionism, and numbing. Those are the ways that we typically avoid vulnerability. She said that it isn't that one person does the foreboding joy and another is a perfectionist. She said that we all use all of them at one time or another. And they are effective ways of putting up that persona, of blocking our authentic self and others to be authentic with us. They were blocking our vulnerability. And I recognized myself in these. I suspect you will too. I think one of the major reasons for going over this kind of thing, you know, I read it, I go, yeah, and we recognize it. To me, one of the major reasons for even doing this, for even talking about these things, is sometimes I think this stuff is inside and we are so used to it being there that we think it is now a part of us. We think that it's real, you know, there's nothing we can do about it. And by going through these things, sometimes we can recognize what it truly is. It is just a way of thinking that we have become conditioned to, and we can change it. I remember some years ago, I went to a workshop. Maria Namath has a class called Mastering Life's Energies, and it was very powerful. One of the exercises was that we were to take the book and go, whatever home was that evening, the hotel or whatever, and look through these phrases. And what they represent are underlying assumptions that we make. And then we live from those assumptions. And her guidance was, find the one that you would hate to have as your underlying assumption, and that's probably yours. So I went home and I went through the list, and there was one underlying assumption that said, the one I would absolutely hate to have was people are stupid. I said, I can't have that as my underlying assumption. I'm a minister, you know. So I got there the next morning. For some reason, she chose me very first. I don't know why, but she said, come on up. And she said, what did you choose last night? And I said, well, the one that I would just hate, people are stupid. And then she began to question me. And it turned out, she said, I don't think that's your underlying conclusion at all. I think it is, life is hard. And I said, well, it is hard. I had made that assumption, life is hard, a reality. You know, I've had some hard life experiences, yes. And at that moment, it was like, wow, really? Life isn't hard? So I think the reason we're doing this, I think, is sometimes to shed light on those things that we have taken as truth. They may not be truth. So let's look at shielding mechanisms. Foreboding joy. Now, this one, I think, is going to be one that you'll go, oh, yeah. It is, everything's going really well, you know, kids are fine, the job's going well, you know, life is pretty good. And in that moment, when you realize that life's going pretty well, then you think, uh-oh, what's going to happen? Something bad is going to happen, and things are going too good, it's too good. You know that feeling, anybody? Yeah, foreboding joy. She said that it is the phrase that it's waiting for the other shoe to fall. And she describes where that phrase come from. I didn't know it. She said that in the early 1900s, immigrants would come into the U.S. and then often they would end up in these big tenements. So there would be different stories. And so when you're living underneath another family and somebody takes off a shoe, usually kind of heavy, that it falls on the floor, and then you know the other one's coming. So once you've waiting for the second shoe, the other shoe to fall, that's where that comes from. And I'm guessing if those were wooden structures, then it would be a loud, you know, waiting for that loud second shoe to fall. This one I thought was really, this point was really interesting. She said that when she was interviewing people about this foreboding joy thing, she was expecting people to reply that this happened when this bad thing was looming or that bad thing was about to happen. And she said what surprised her was most often it was when people were feeling great joy. As an example she used was when she was looking down at her sleeping child. You know, there's nothing that just melts your heart. If I can still, you know, my son's 40, and I can still remember looking down into the crib and getting that heart swell, you know, just, oh my gosh, I love him so much. That is one of the times when we feel most vulnerable. There we are in our love, you know, just there, our hearts are open, and we feel most vulnerable. When we realize, I've heard Dan talk about how much he loves Beth, and sometimes it just kind of scares him because of that love. Yeah. It is. That's often when we feel the most vulnerable, when we are feeling the most joy. Coping mechanisms. One of the things that, and I used to do this, when we start feeling good, you know, but something bad could happen. One coping mechanism is to imagine the worst, and then if something good happens, you're pleasantly surprised. I used to do that. You know? So for different scenarios, well, you know, there's, you know, so-and-so, maybe this may be a possibility for promotion. Well, I probably won't get it. You know, I just tried to prepare for the worst. And then if you do get it, then you're happily surprised. But that isn't really being vulnerable. That is another form of hiding, of shielding yourself. So what do we do if we find ourselves doing this foreboding thing, waiting for the second shoe, thinking that something bad is going to happen? She said for each of these shielding mechanisms, there is an antidote, something that we can use to change things, to begin to see it in a different way. So the antidote is practice gratitude. Practice gratitude. She had a wonderful example. When we're feeling that overwhelming joy and a scary thought comes up, like, oh my gosh, this could happen. My loved one could die or get run over or you know, any, you know, those fears, they pop up sometimes. But when those things happen, here's an example. She said, it took me a couple of years to understand and integrate this information and to start to cultivate a gratitude practice. Ellen is her daughter. Ellen, on the other hand, seemed to intuitively understand the importance of acknowledging and owning joy. When she was in the first grade, we played hooky one afternoon and spent the day at the park. At one point where we were on a paddle boat, feeding ducks stale bread that we had brought from home, when I realized that she had stopped pedaling and was sitting perfectly still in her seat. Her hands were wrapped around the bread sack, her head was tilted back, and her eyes were closed. The sun was shining on her uplifted face, and she had a quiet smile on her face. I was so struck by her beauty and her vulnerability that I could barely catch my breath. I watched for a full minute, but when she didn't move, I got a little nervous. Ellie, is everything okay, sweetie? Her smile widened and she opened her eyes. She looked at me and said, "I'm fine, Mama. I was just making a picture memory." I had never heard of a picture memory, but I liked the sound of it. What's that mean? "Oh, a picture memory is a picture I take in my mind when I'm really, really happy. I close my eyes and take a picture, so when I'm feeling sad or scared or lonely, I can look at my picture memories." I'm not as eloquent or poised as my then 6-year-old daughter, but I've been practicing. For me, expressing gratitude is still bumpier than it is graceful or fluid. I still get overwhelmed with vulnerability in the midst of joyful experiences, but now I've learned to literally say aloud, "I'm feeling vulnerable and I'm so grateful for," fill in the blank. And that can be a really good way to turn that around. So when we are in the midst of some joyful thing and you feel that, something's going to happen, there is vulnerability raising its head again, and what do I see that I'm grateful for? I'm grateful for my daughter. I'm grateful for my whatever. The second shielding mechanism, of course, I never did this. Perfectionism. Who feels guilty of being a perfectionist at times? Yeah, it's really common. She says, I love this, she says, she's a recovering perfectionist and aspiring good enoughist. Cute. So then she talks about perfectionism. She says what it is and what it isn't. I think sometimes people have the impression that, well, it's good to be a perfectionist because then, you know, then you're trying to be better. You're trying to do the best job you have. Here's what she says. Perfectionism isn't the same thing as striving for excellence. It's not. We do want to do better, to achieve more, but being perfect isn't it. So that it is not the same thing as striving for excellence. Second thing is, perfectionism is not self-improvement. It is at its core trying for approval. That we have this ingrained belief that if we can be perfect, then people will accept us, they will love us, but it really isn't about the perfection. Not really. And third, perfectionism is not the key to success. Actually, it says that perfectionism hampers success. Hampers achievement. Have you ever heard of analysis paralysis? That we had that phrase back when I was in the corporate world, and you always wanted to look at a task, a challenge, a problem, until you had enough information. But if you overanalyze, if you just stay in that, let's say, well, let me wait for one more piece of data, you get into that perfectionism paralysis kind of thing. So it's not the key to success. And finally, perfectionism is not a way to avoid shame. It's actually a form of shame. So if that's what perfectionism is not, here's what she says it is. It is a self-destructive and addictive belief system that fuels this primary thought. If I look perfect and do everything perfectly, I can avoid or minimize the painful feelings of shame, judgment, and blame. Self-destructive and addictive. Second, perfectionism is self-destructive simply because perfection doesn't exist. It's an unattainable goal. Third, perfectionism is addictive because when we invariably do experience shame, judgment, and blame, we often think it's because, or believe it's because we weren't perfect enough. So we keep trying to be better, to be more, and it's never, never enough. Perfectionism actually sets us up to feel shame, judgment, and blame, which then leads to more. So it just escalates. Perfectionism is sometimes a tough one to deal with. You know, when it grabs hold, it can be overwhelming. The antidote, she says, is be willing to give ourselves a break and appreciate the beauty of our cracks or imperfections. give ourselves a break, be willing to appreciate the beauty of our cracks or our imperfections. Two things. I think body image is just so glaringly set in the media to cause us to feel bad about what we're not, you know, not young, not slim, not, you know, whatever, tall, not short, not whatever. Usually we're not. So then they have these products that they want to sell us so that we can be, but we can't be. So body image is one area that I think perfectionism, the media, the marketers really hone in on our perfectionism to try to sell us something so that we can try to be what we think perfection is, and it is not. On body image, if we can get to the point of whether it's our body image or our way of being, you know, remember we said that the antidote for the whole thing, the best way of being okay with vulnerability is to believe that we are enough. You know? So on this perfectionism thing, if we can look at ourselves, just give ourselves a break. Well, you know what? I can do this. I may be this age, but I can do this. I may be female, but I can do this. I may be male, but I can do this. When we give ourselves a break and just sort of acknowledge, accept our imperfections, it's better. There's a wonderful little story about a pitcher who felt, or a, I remember, a bucket or something, and it one was not cracked, the other one was, and the farmer or whatever would fill both of them up and carry them both back and forth, you know, to water something, and one was feeling really bad because it had this crack and was telling the farmer at some point, I feel terrible because by the time you get to what this, you know, the crop, I'm empty. I don't have any water. And he says, no, it's okay. Take a look at the path, and there are all these flowers that have bloomed, you know. So even the cracks are wonderful. The other thing I wanted to mention is I was at Unity Village this past week. I was taking part in a credentialing team meeting, which was wonderful, and being at the village is so nourishing. There is a huge labyrinth that's painted on a parking lot. And so it's the black asphalt. There are cracks in the top, you know, in the asphalt. And I even wrote a paper once when I was in ministerial school about cracks in our consciousness. Because as I walk that labyrinth and I see the places where the asphalt has been cracked, it's been patched, and so there's a place where it's even stronger than it was before. There's a place where the crack is now, you know, something's growing out of it. I thought it was such a wonderful metaphor for us and our lives. We can avoid the armor of the shield of perfectionism by giving ourselves a break and just being grateful for acknowledging all that we offer, warts and all. Yeah. And the third strategy for avoiding shielding mechanism for avoiding vulnerability is called numbing. Numbing things like staying crazy busy. Numbing is, you know, all the addictions, drinking, the, you know, anything can be addicting. The need, it says, most powerful numbing comes from a combination of shame, anxiety, and disconnection. So when those things are present, then we don't want to feel uncomfortable. We don't want to feel pain, and we don't want to cry. So we want to numb. We do that. She went to some length to talk about the various ways that we can numb. Certainly, alcohol, drugs, shopping. Shopping can be a shopaholic, a workaholic. People who spend, you know, 60, 70, 80 hours a week at work often do that because they don't want to deal with whatever's going on. So lots of ways that we numb ourselves. The antidote for this is setting boundaries, finding true comfort, and three, cultivating spirit. I think these are wonderful tools to use. There are times when we get overwhelmed, when we are experiencing challenges, and that's when all that you know, the shame stuff starts jumping in. We start wanting to find ways to numb our pain, our discomfort. The antidote, though, first is like setting boundaries. One of them is setting boundaries. If we are, we can be in one of two groups. I loved what she said here. Let's see if I can find. Here we go. Okay. So she's talking about types of people. She says, when it comes to anxiety, we all struggle. There are different types of anxiety and certainly different intensities. Some anxiety is hardwired and best addressed with a combination of medication and therapy, and some of it is environmental. We're overextended and overstressed. What was interesting to me was how the participants could be divided into two camps. Group A defined the challenge of anxiety as finding ways to manage and soothe the anxiety. Group B clearly defined the problem as changing the behaviors that led to anxiety. An example of what that looks like. Group A. I make a pot of coffee after I tuck in my kids so I can take care of all the emails between 10 and midnight. If there are too many, I wake up at 4 a.m. and start over again. I don't like getting to work with any unanswered email in my box. I'm exhausted, but they're answered. That's group A. That's one way to do it. Group B. I've simply stopped sending unnecessary emails and asked my friends and colleagues to do the same. I've also started setting the expectation that it might take me a few days to respond. If it's important, call me. Don't text or email, call. Better yet, stop by my office. The second one is setting boundaries, is beginning to say, well, wait a minute, these things are stressors. The first person, you know, if isn't changing anything. So if there's a greater number of emails coming in, she or he is going to start getting up at 3, you know, or staying up until 1. So pretty, it's not making it better. Setting boundaries is an important piece. She talks about how important it is to be enough, to be enough. So if we can hold on to that enoughness, then it is much easier to set boundaries because we don't have to accept others' expectations. Sometimes we might need to negotiate, but if we can keep that place that we are whole, that we want to stay whole, then we're better off. Okay, this one I thought was interesting. Numbing devices versus shadow comforts. And I related to this one too. You've had a hard day at work, really hard day of work, and then you come out and your tire's flat, but you finally make the tire changed and you get home. And so what do? You might eat a half a chocolate cake. That's a shadow comfort. The difference is, she said, it isn't what we consume. The comfort, the shadow comfort, is something that could be a way to nourish ourselves. It's the frame of mind that we have when we are doing it, using, you know, doing whatever. So we could be having a piece of chocolate, maybe cake, and savoring it. We're in a good place. I am enough, and we love it. I am feeling not enough, and so I eat the chocolate cake as a way of comforting. Or so that's where that comes from. Oh, there was a wonderful section in here and this had to do, I think, with the last part, the cultivating spirit. She was talking about we are all in this together, and she was talking about how if we can cultivate, connection and belonging are just hardwired into us. She did like a 3-page blog sort of thing in here about her experience. Started out, she had her nails done. She went to a shop that she had gone to for years, was having her nails done by a person who has done her nails for 10 years, The person knows her name. She knows the person's name. They both know each other's kids' names. They have a relationship. And she was watching other customers who were being served, who were on their phones, who never even made contact with the person that was working on them, did the whole transaction, you know, paid for it and everything without any acknowledgement even that the person was there. She left there and she went to a bookstore, Barnes & Noble, to pick up a book or something that she wanted. Again, there was someone ahead of her in line. She watched the person go up to the clerk, and she was on the phone also. And so the whole time, talked on the phone, didn't even make contact with or eye contact with the salesperson, got out her payment and did all of it and walked away without any interaction at all. And then the third example was, after that, she left the bookstore. She went through a drive-through, fast food drive-through, to get a Dr. Pepper or something. And she ordered it, and as she was driving up to the window, her phone rang, and she thought it was school or something, so she answered it. It wasn't that, so she got off the phone quickly. When she turned to the woman at the window, she said, "I apologize. The phone rang just as I was driving up here, and I thought it was school, but I got off as quickly as I could." The person at the window got tears in her eyes and said, "Thank you for saying that." She said, "You don't know how many people just never even acknowledge that we're here." A way to shield ourselves from this numbing, I think, is to remember that we're all in this together. And that if we can make these connections, if we can realize we all belong to the human race, we all have imperfections, we'll be better off. There were a few less frequented kinds of ways of shielding. One was biking or victim. That's a win-lose kind of thing. And she said, you see this more like military or police or surprisingly lawyers. She said the suicide rate for lawyers is like 4 times higher than the general public. And it has to do with, you know, seeing life that way, winners and losers. Another one, or the antidote for that one, is redefining success. The last one is cynicism, criticism, cool, and cruelty. And she talks about this one. You know, we all know cynics. Sometimes we're cynical ourselves. Those are ways of avoiding being vulnerable. She was talking about middle school kids and how everybody in the middle school class has a hoodie. You know, they all have them. And there are times when they put up the hoodie and put their hands in their pockets and then they look like everybody else. You know, it's a way to hide. And we kind of do that too by joining in and trying to be like everybody else, being critical like everybody else, doing all that. It's a way to avoid pain. The antidote, she calls it tightrope walking, practicing shame resilience, and reality checking. Tightrope walking is just a way of kind of like discerning, not too much this way, not too much that way. Life experiences, I guess really what I would say is sort of trusting ourselves to really discern whether this is how I want to walk. Do I want to open myself, or is this, there's more in here, but it's a one way. The one I thought was most interesting is that it referred back to last week, again, with the resilience part. When you encounter the cynicism, criticism, cool, or cruel, the best thing is to do what we do for shame resilience. Understand what triggered the attack, what it means in our own self-worth, talking to people that you trust about it, and then asking for what you need. So just what we talked about last week. Remember that same resilience. The last thing that she says I thought was just hilarious. I laughed out loud with it. In that cool and cruel part, she said this was actually written by someone, and she cited it. When it's talking about the haters and the people who are going to be really, really saying mean and ugly things to you or about you, she said, "Don't try to win over the haters. You're not the jackass whisperer. Indeed. She's just plain and outspoken. It's really good. And that's really true, though. Being vulnerable. So we wind up this portion of this with again, an understanding that it is uncomfortable to be vulnerable. It may be uncomfortable to think about going to this sacred conversation session this afternoon, perhaps. I don't know. But it is in being vulnerable that we find the most bliss, that we can most readily be all that we can be. And it brings great satisfaction. So I think it behooves us then to dare greatly. To prepare us for meditation, Mitzi is going to play, and we'll...
To feel God's presence, we are here to feel this love. Breathe in beauty, breathe out all fear. Just let it go and rise above. I
invite you, if you haven't already, to gently close your outer eyes. The music is soothing. And it invites us to go deeper. To take our attention away from all of the outer experiences, thoughts, to simply become present here and now. And it is, as Mitzi sang before, it is when we take the time to go within, to pull away from all of the outer challenges, the busyness, the things that take us away from the truth of our beings. It is when we center ourselves once again in the quiet that we reconnect, that we have an opportunity to be nourished. We have the opportunity to be re-energized. We become open and willing and receptive to strength and comfort and guidance. As we are still, we begin to feel a sense of peace and well-being that is internal. And it grows and magnifies, bringing us great, great calm. It helps us to know our enoughness. When we make this connection, by being silent and open and receptive, by making this stillness a part of our everyday routine, we realign with that truth of us. We remember who and what we really are. And we rest, and we are renewed, and we are better able then to go back out into the world peaceful, renewed, knowing and trusting that the power that is within us will sustain us, will guide us through any difficult challenge. And so this morning we do remember who we are, what we are. We do acknowledge that we want to dare greatly, that we want to be authentic, we want to be real. We want to shed the shields that we carry around. We want to live life more wholly, more completely. And so in that awareness, let us, as we do each week, set aside just these few moments in stillness to simply be, to be peace, to be joy, to be love in the silence. And we breathe. We are renewed. We come away from these times of connection, of communion, feeling refreshed, remembering that we are so loved, remembering that the very essence of us is love. We bask in that awareness. And we are grateful. We are grateful for certainly the knowing. We are grateful for these opportunities to come together, to remember together. We are grateful for this community that is loving and supportive as we move along our spiritual path. And we are grateful for our wholeness. As we do each week, we end this time of contemplation by repeating the words, praying the words that our master teacher and way shower taught us. Jesus taught us the Lord's Prayer, and we affirm it together now. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not in temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen.